Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. Joining me once again, and it's been too long, is John Mills. John, welcome back.
It has been entirely too long, Sean, but it's entirely disorienting because this isn't a sequel, is it?
It's not a sequel. We're going to have to start from scratch this one. Not only is it not a sequel, we're doing, I want to say for the first time since Twin Peaks, when we did the series and Fire Walk With Me, where you are the one introducing the movie to me.
That's an excellent point. You're absolutely right. Yeah,
I think it's been a long time, and I am almost positive this is the first time in a long time. And the movie we are going to be watching is The Wild Bunch. Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. One of your favorite movies.
As it turns out, yes. Yes, it is.
How convenient.
I saw this film for the first time back in college during a film analysis class, and kind of fell in love with it. I can't remember if it was assigned for the class or if the teacher had mentioned it, because we were talking about like John Ford movies and Westerns and stuff like that. But I remember it was around the time that it was somewhere around the time because I wound up purchasing the director's cut on videotape. Ooh, VHS. And picture quality like you wouldn't believe.
I imagine.
You know, I mean, just the best. And that's really the story of sort of falling in love with it. And it's really interesting because this is one of those films that I have found is, and I know how corny this type of stuff always sounds, but it is like wine in the sense that there are certain lines, certain interactions, certain character arcs that speak more to me the older I've gotten, as opposed to when I was younger. When I was younger, I appreciated it a certain way, and now that I'm older, I appreciate it in an entirely different way.
So when's the last time you watched it?
Years ago, actually. Many years ago. And it's one of those ones where it, in my opinion, it asks a lot of you emotionally and intellectually in terms of understanding and relating to these characters, and as a result, it's not something you lightly grab off the shelf. This is sort of like Heat. Yeah, I got a couple hours free. I'm not going to pull Heat off the shelf unless I really want to watch Heat. You know,
Heat is that's an interesting pick because I've only seen Heat once, and I saw it in college, and it was. I'm glad you said that because Heat is a movie I didn't necessarily connect to. And I think I was expecting a completely different kind of movie. And it hurt my viewing of the film because I was also, since I was younger, I was very much like, if it doesn't meet A, B, C, D, and all these other things I want, it's not a good movie. Not that I didn't like Heat, but I was definitely disappointed. So I'm glad you said that just to kind of prep me. But as far as Westerns go, is this top of the pit? Like, is this at the top of your list, or where does it rank for you?
Yes.
Wow.
It is top of the list. I have a now. See, the thing is, it's always a loaded statement to say, "Oh, I love Westerns," because people then expect you to have seen like every Western ever made, or something. And I haven't. But I do have a fondness for the genre, even when it's cheesily executed. You know, I still dig it. Because I just love the era. I love the whole concept of the lawlessness inherent in a land that wasn't sure of its own identity at the time.
Yep.
And people going there that weren't sure of their own identities at the time. And just sort of that interplay of, you know, there's so much natural drama and tension that carries through with that. And I mean, in terms of Westerns, what's interesting is it's also a loaded statement because this isn't your typical Western. Mm. And I think that I think that Wild Bunch is a movie that wound up setting a different type of expectation for action and westerns. Like, it's all John Ford before this, basically. And then after Wild Bunch, the nature of the western changed pretty
well. You've
got to
remember Sergio Leone, the Man with No Name trilogy, which was, I think, right before this. I double-checked to be sure, because while we're on the subject of westerns, that was a genre I came to later on. It never much appealed to me as a kid growing up, even going through college. I remember, this is another movie I would love to see again, and it doesn't qualify as a missing frame technically, but it's one that I know is one of your favorites, but Tombstone. My roommate showed me Tombstone, and I was not on the wavelength of that movie at all. And part of it was just a general dislike for westerns. I just wasn't into them. And my senior year of college, what happened was a little video game called Red Dead Redemption came out. Huh. And I got that game, and I absolutely adored it. And it just, a switch went off, and I was like, I need to see every Western I can get my hands on. And I think my what really bridged the gap for me was The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That was sure. The first one I watched when I had just opened myself up to, like, yes, I'm willing to embrace this genre. And I think that's such a great one to pick because it is so just visually stunning. It's got the classic archetype of Clint Eastwood. You've got a lot of elements to it that work. And then it just kicked the door open. I did Once Upon a Time in the West, The Searchers, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, all these movies, and really, really embraced the Western, but never got around to Wild Bunch for whatever reason.
Well, Wild Bunch is, I think, even as it's grouped with Westerns rightfully, it's still an outlier even among that group. And that is because if you mentioned specifically the Man with No Name trilogy, those are small, intimate, focused sorts of things, whereas Wild Bunch is much larger. It's a much larger canvas. It's a much larger cast of characters. It's a much larger story, and it has much more of a... If you look at the Man with No Name movies, it's very direct, very linear, and Wild Bunch is linear as well, of course. You know, there's a beginning, middle, end sort of approach to it, but there's a lot of use of... the characters are more fleshed out. The Man with No Name can exist as the Man with No Name because he's the good guy and he shows up. Gotcha. Right. I'm all set. Oh, and there's an interesting bad guy. Cool.
Exactly. And the first one, one of the brilliant things about Westerns, they were very almost our take on the samurai film. In some way, especially that trilogy, the first one, A Fistful of Dollars, is almost a shot for shot, maybe not shot for shot, but beat for beat, it's a remake of Yojimbo, Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo. So there's,
right.
I think I when I started to pay attention to these things, and I just had been starting to get into Kurosawa really, and watching his stuff and learning more about him and understanding the cinematic language and the history and seeing the comparisons, and I think that helped a lot too. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, there's Magnificent Seven, which I've never seen, which was a remake of Seven Samurai. Is Wild Bunch of a similar ilk, not necessarily entertainment value, but the idea of... I know nothing about this movie, but is it anything along those lines?
No. No, it is not. It is its own thing, and it is... It was very controversial in its day. Remember a story. I don't remember where I read it, but I remember a story that after some premiere of the film, it was received so poorly for its violence that, like, Peckinpah sat there with his arms crossed and his head down, like, basically just being buffeted by... Because this is another thing where I think with time also, the violence in this, by today's standards, you know, okay... Sure. Right. But for back then, it's like, oh my goodness. But the thing is, even though the makeup effects don't have like exploding heads or things like that, the magnitude of action in this film is, I think it still stands up there. It still okay. ranks. It still ranks in the discussion for just going for broke in a lot of ways.
I mean, that sounds fantastic. And yeah. This is one you suggested to me. It wasn't even on my radar. It's a movie I've known about, but it wasn't on my radar of like, I need to see this. And then when you mentioned it, it was like, oh yeah, why haven't I seen that? So my anticipation level is I'm excited. I know you're a big fan. I've heard a lot of great things about it, but I know so little about this movie. I know the actor who played Marty is in it from the movie Marty. Sam Peckinpah. I've never seen a Sam Peckinpah.
You mean
movie.
Ernest Borgnine?
Yes, that actor.
Yes, he's also in Escape from New York.
I haven't seen that either.
What?
That's another one I need to see. Yeah, what? John, Missing Frames has been an education in John Carpenter for me. Brad Gullickson, we just did Big Trouble in Little China, which I was a fan of.
And that was a beautiful episode, and that's a beautiful film. That's absolutely, you know what Jack Burton says in a situation like this.
No, tell me, John.
Well, no, I'm going to make everybody watch. Listen, you know what? Listen to the episode of Missing Frames that has to do with Big Trouble in Little China while watching Big Trouble in Little China, and then you'll get the joke.
Perfect.
There you go.
Thank
there
you. Go. Plugging my own show for me. That's why I have you back all the time. But yeah, I don't know much about this movie. I've kind of purposely kept it. As you can tell, I'm extremely ignorant. All I know is it was released in 1969. Like you said, it was. I read a little bit about the violence, that it was very controversial when it came out. It sounds like it's going to be an interesting viewing experience at the very least, but I am genuinely excited to watch it.
I'm glad that you are. I sincerely hope I haven't built it up too much. That's always a danger with these sorts of things. But I think that with your eye, you'll, even if you don't wind up loving it as much as I do, you'll be able to see and understand why somebody might.
Fair enough. Well, yeah. Let's find out, shall we?
Let's.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. John, this is a fantastic film.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, Sean. You have no idea. Like I said before, it's so nerve-wracking. You know, you do
this
show.
I know, we've been through this.
Yeah.
But through this before.
And it's so nerve-wracking to introduce a beloved film to somebody and be like, I hope they like it. But I'm so thrilled. I'm so thrilled to hear that you enjoyed it. I'm dying to know what your high points were. That's my first question.
Well, I'm glad you kind of prepped me for. I hadn't really looked up much about The Wild Bunch. I'm glad you mentioned the kind of somber tone. I don't know if you explicitly said it was somber, but the hints I kept getting from you whenever I was like, "Is it like this? Is it like that?" I was like, "Is it like, you know, a little like Magnificent Seven?" And you were like, "No." And yeah. You're right. It's not the Magnificent Seven. If anything, it's almost the anti Magnificent Seven. Not overtly. It's not necessarily condemning that camaraderie, but it's so much it is the passing of an era. It's that kind of movie. You're watching the ending of an era in a really kind of sad, depressing film. It's never to the point where it's not enjoyable to watch, but it was very, I was very in tune from the beginning when you have this incredible shootout, and almost instantly I'm like, oh, okay, this is why people were so up in arms about this movie in terms of the violence. You know, by today's standard, it feels tame, but you can kind of tune into that mindset, and while I'll never fully understand it, you could be like, oh yeah, this is intense. But they kept showing shots of like kids in the street and yes. the bodies. It was never celebrated. They're escaping. No. They get what they think is the silver. They get out of there. And instead of like a celebratory, like dun 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 dun, we're going off into the sunset. We did it. We stay with the town and the bodies on the street and people crying and mourning and this, you know, everyone's angry and upset. Like, how can we let this happen? There's never a point in this movie where a victory feels like a victory. It's always feels kind of dirty.
And that is, I think, you know, to get to the beginning, that's one of the most beautiful things about it is it immediately establishes neither side is the good guys here.
Mm.
They both suck. Like, not you don't like, you like people because, like, Ernest Borgnine is, you know, he's him. And so, yes. like, there's that joyous energy that he has, but at the same time, there's that undercurrent of menace where you appreciate the fact that these are all terrible people. And it's not that the railroad wants to bring them to justice. It's that they're a problem and the railroad just needs to kill them all. Like, we just right. want the problem over with. We don't care about jail. We don't care about a trial. You just take care of this problem. And just so everybody knows, we're not really spoiling anything. This is like the first 5 minutes of the movie, basically, that we're talking about here. But the stuff with the children, especially throughout the film, it's so telling. And I'll never forget the first time I saw this with a professor explaining it. It was in a film analysis class. So it's not like I was like, I don't understand this movie. It was like, it was part of the discussion. But he drew special attention to the very beginning. You see them seeing children doing a really kind of terrible thing. They're yeah. torturing and killing.
Well, I was wondering, I was like, what's the symbolism here? We're watching, it's a very stylized opening credits. You know,
oh, yeah.
they freeze frame, it's black and white. It was almost like, I was like, what's the pace? If this is kind of throwing off the pacing. And it wasn't until the end of the movie where I kind of realized the opening is kind of, you're freeze framing this moment in time that is passing mm-hmm. in a way. But I remember watching those kids and trying to pick it out. And just sort of as the film went on, I'm sure you're about to get to this. And I'm sorry to interrupt and ruin it.
Oh, no.
But
no.
like it, just feeling that sense of like everyone is just enjoying the spectacle and kind of like will like they just want to they invest themselves in this kind of violence and. In some ways, the children are almost, I guess, the audience that ended up really embracing this movie, despite the violence, or embracing the violence.
I think really is that the movie has a pessimistic anthropology, that we tend to look back at childhood and, you know, it's very much the urge, especially as you get older, to look back and say, oh, my gosh, things were better when I was a kid. And it's like, no, you just weren't aware of exactly how much trouble there was in the world.
Right.
You know, it's not that the world is suddenly on fire. It's that you paid attention to the smoke this time. And you're like, oh, that's what that was. And I think that there is a symbolism just through the whole movie about you have to... they're basically counseled at one point, just accept the fact that you can't be a kid. And the whole movie's been telling you that even when you were a kid, a lot of you were still a-holes, you know,
right.
like it's one of those sorts of things. And
right.
I think that opening action sequence, the thing that I think is absolutely the thing that made me fall in love with the film immediately is just the absolutely, I don't want to say courageous, but definitely tone-setting decision to have a shootout happen while a temperance parade
yes.
is marching through the center of town.
The temperance parade is their cover. They're like,
yes.
let's go, and they grab the yes. women, and this is our cover. This is how we're going to get out of here.
And you stay back here and hold these hostages so they don't get away. And
right.
like, it's just, and that sick, twisted guy that they leave behind who's reveling in that stuff. And it's not that they had any emotional attachment to him, but when they find, why didn't you tell me he was your nephew? it's you realize it's this, it's such a complex set of relationships that are set up in this film.
Right.
And as it continues forward, it's such, because, you know, you were asking about it in the vein of the Man with No Name trilogy. Mm. And that's really a distinct difference. There's no hero. Yeah. That's what makes this such an atypical Western. Even if you have something like the Outlaw Josie Wales, where, you know, or High Plains Drifter or Unforgiven, there's still a moment where that fallen person decides to be a hero. Even in The Searchers, right, has that with John Wayne coming back from the war and he turns around and he decides to become the hero again.
Yeah, there's a sort Nobody's of redemption or yeah. some sort of arc that the hero, it's never quite victorious, but the hero comes back and does the heroic right. deed to redeem themselves. But it's interesting you bring up the kids, because one of the notes I wrote down, one of the quotes I absolutely loved is the we all dream of being a child again, even the worst of us, perhaps the worst most of all. I found that real moving, and it's very evocative of the themes of this movie. Like you said, there's this constant kind of longing for the past, trying to cling to it. The relationship between William Holden, I can't remember their characters' names. I think it's Pike and Dutch.
Yes,
they Pike, are kind of the
Deke. It's Pike and Deke.
Pike and Deke. Well, they have. There's Pike and Deke.
You're talking about Ernest Borgnine. Yeah, Dutch.
Right.
Yeah, Pike
exactly.
And Dutch.
Or Ernest
Sorry.
Borgnine and William Holden. Their relationship. They're kind of what the Western, the buddies we're used to seeing. You know,
yeah.
They're the two leftover remaining members of the Seven Samurai who are now saddled with. They have the camaraderie, they have the friendship and the relationship and the love for each other, but they have this kind of ragtag group of guys who are just, you get the sense that it's like, what are we all doing here? And they're trying to uphold, and they are even having conversations about, like, we're going to have this one last job, and then
right.
we're going to get out of it. And then Dutch, to which, I can't remember the line exactly, but Dutch is kind of like, what are we going to go back to? What do you have to go back to?
Right.
And the whole movie is filled with moments like that where no victory is allowed. No one's allowed to celebrate. They get out, and sure, we're going to go into spoilers for people who haven't seen this movie. But, you know, they rob the railroad. They think they've got this big haul. This is the last one. We're going to retire. And they leave. And not only are we left with the aftermath of their shootout, which is, again, extremely grim. But then they find out they were set up. They have washers. They don't even get what they came for. And
yep.
Their victory is very short-lived. And just very reflective of the movie.
It's also, I'm glad you keep saying, you know, a bygone era sort of thing. And there is that whole feeling through the whole movie of recap. I think that this would... You could count this really as a trailblazing sort of film, because it's the first Western that pops into my head as one that reevaluates the romanticized Western. It's an answer to John Ford, basically, saying, no, things weren't really like that. And how ahead of its time that is ridiculous, because most people think of the reimagined Western philosophy as starting with, like, Unforgiven. But that's not really true.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, so this is very much a forebear. And I think that one of the great sins of recent film history is this film is not talked about enough.
No, it doesn't feel like it.
Really it.
Like I said, it wasn't necessarily, I don't remember, but what I did was when I got into the Western genre and I was looking up all these movies to watch, The Wild Bunch, I don't ever remember seeing. Like, it wasn't
right.
on my radar, and I'd heard of it, it was in the back of my mind, but it was funny when we talked about doing this episode, it was just kind of like, oh yeah, why hadn't I done that? And I kind of started doing some research, and it's held in such high esteem by so many film scholars and critics, and for good reason. But you're right, it kind of has fallen out of the lexicon. What do you think it is? I mean, is it necessarily that movies like Unforgiven have done it better? Or why do you think this movie is kind of sort of not disappeared, but isn't talked about as much?
I definitely don't think that Unforgiven did it better, but I definitely think that this is a victim of the era in which it was released. Because 1969, right? Mm. People are you mentioned movies from this era, and people are thinking of like Easy Rider. And then shortly before, not too long before this, you know, Vertigo. And then Star Wars shows up and Jaws shows up. So it really, in a sense, gets, I mean, Godfather is 1972. So this sort of gets lost in the shuffle in terms of the impact that it made. And its initial reception wasn't terribly warm.
Right.
And so I think that works against it as well. You don't think of The Wild Bunch as, oh, yeah, that's one of those 60s films that challenged and changed things. And what's a real, I think, to turn that into a positive, what a real beautiful thing about that is it's almost like, especially, you know, you're talking about you started getting into the Western. It wasn't something you were always into. It's almost like when somebody discovers a band that you've loved for some time and they haven't gotten to that most magical album. And you go, oh, wait until you hear this one. And you put it on for them and they go, they were even better than I thought. It's like, I know, right? Isn't this great? So I think, in a sense, I think that the beautiful thing is that it doesn't allow this to become cheapened, right? Well, because you go into an Easy Rider and there's such an expectation set for it, you can't help but be disappointed.
Yeah, part of me wonders, like you said, I think it is very much because it was so of its era, and I think a lot of it has to do with the violence. I think people were so put off by it, but that was the talking point. Like that, when I was watching interviews with Ernest Borgnine and watching Leonard Maltin talk about this movie, and both of them relate stories about how the critic screening or the first screening, critics were like catcalling them and mocking them and like, how could you? The first question that Borgnine recalls is, why would you make this movie? And he was just so struck by that, like, what do you mean? Why would we make it? It's a great movie. Like we wanted to tell the story, but they were so put off by the violence. And part of me wonders if because the violence so overshadowed the quality of the film, at least in that era, people just kind of dismissed it as kind of an exploitation film. Because this is also a big motivator for the Motion Picture Association getting together and coming up with the rating system. This is like, I think this was one of the first like big R-rated movies that like was out at the time. Like it was a big controversy, but I almost feel like the violence overwhelmed the reputation in a way. People were so turned off by that they weren't paying attention to what it was really doing, and that it was really a condemnation of violence. The violence isn't glorified in this movie at all. It feels brutal and nasty.
Right. Compare its approach to something like, and I'm not bad-mouthing the series because you know I adore it, but like Fast and the Furious or even a Marvel movie. Mm. Violence is just, oh, cool, look, he snapped that guy's neck. Oh, cool, look, he hit him in the face with the shield. It's like this movie takes the time to say, well, just so you know, look at all of the dead people.
Yes.
Look at all of these awful, terrible things that happen because people can be awful to each other.
Yeah.
And now I'm also going to say, you mentioned spoilers earlier, and yes, we're kind of getting spoilery, but I consider this a spoiler-proof film. I could tell you everything that happens in this, and it does not lessen the impact of what it's saying. You know, what's happening on screen isn't what's happening in your heart or in your mind while you're watching it.
Although I would not have appreciated knowing that they all die at the end. I mean, you kind of know it. You know it's just going there. But at the same time, the gut listen, punch of seeing that happen.
That moment, and this is very spoilery, but that moment when everything's frozen, when they've shot Mapache, and they look at each other, and you know what's about to happen, I can't watch that. And the thing is, it's even this thing of what's beautiful about it is that's the moment where these guys appreciate. It's almost it's Shakespearean. Mm. You know, when Hamlet kills Polonius, spoilers, he says, He basically says, oh, well, I know what's going to happen to me now, so I'm going to go get things all set and, right. and try to get about it. And that's that moment with them where yeah. they go, there's no way this ends differently, is
yes,
there?
Yes, I love
so
that.
So let's just
was,
have
it
fun.
It was hard to, at first it was like, what's going on? Is this like just so stylized? It's happening in slow motion. They're all kind of
yeah.
looking at each other. And then he laughs and you realize yeah. it's just like, he can't, like nobody's doing, all right, well, let's just do this thing.
But even that simple moment of killing Mapachi is everything freezes because you realize even the statement that makes, whether it's intentional or not, of how, you know, the strong man, of how the dictator is powered purely by the illusion of invincibility. Mm. And it's shocking when a person like that gets killed because,
right.
oh, we could have. You mean we didn't
yes.
have? Huh,
that was the vibe. You know? That's what I thought they were going for. Is like they didn't know how. Like at first they didn't know how to react, which I think is what it was. But it was confusing until Borgnine's character laughed and then just shoots the guy, and it's just like, oh my god! And then it goes nuts again. The carnage yes. in this movie is off the charts. But yeah. like it's nasty. It's not really. You don't feel good about it. It's cool, and you can appreciate the technique, and he does a real interesting thing with the intercutting when people are shot and falling.
Yes.
He intercuts a lot with two different people falling in two different locations, and it creates a weird sort of rhythm, and it's almost hypnotizing in a way. But yep. You have the really cool moment where Holden's character goes into the room, shoots the guy behind the mirror, and you're like, yeah, he's such a badass. And then the girl shoots him. And yep. you're like, what? And then he shoots her, and you're like, not one moment do we just get to like revel in like, oh, the heroism. There is no heroism.
And I don't know what word to use for this, but how bizarre for a Western to show women performing a violent act,
yes.
as opposed to being cowering. She sits there and uses his presumption that because she's a woman, she's not going to do anything to her advantage. And
right.
that's basically his downfall.
Yes.
And it's just this, again, Shakespearean thing of, well, you should have counted on that one guy. You
right.
know, look at where you are. And it's
yeah, exactly.
It's,
I mean, the whole thing yeah. ends. I mean, all the guys just, they end up dying. But the beauty of that is the movie is very focused on, in addition to kind of it's the passing of an era, it's kind of a No Country for Old Men. Like that could have been
yeah.
the alternative title of this movie, No Country for Old Men, because it feels that way, where it's like these guys don't have a place in this society anymore, and the times are moving. Every single moment with them, I mean, I remember when they are leaving the Mexican village, Angel's village, and I just remember that was the first moment where I was like, oh, they're really, really milking this theme of like these guys are the ending, the passing. They're like seeing them off, and it's almost like a funeral dirge. They're kind of like it goes on and on and on, and it's beautifully shot. But that's inherent throughout the film. But beyond that, there's a strong theme of camaraderie and mm-hmm. what it means to be in a gang like this and the importance of loyalty and family, which are the only positive ideals that they kind of cling to almost as justification for what they're doing.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the temperance movement is this whole thing of like civilization encroaching on this wild land. Like before, you know, these guys are from an era of before, it's like Jack Napier in the 1989 Batman. Decent people shouldn't live here. They'd be happier someplace else, right? And that's
right.
sort of what's driving them, you know, to the margins. And, you know, that whole question of loyalty, because, you know, Deke, he's worse than anything to them. Look at the way they live their lives, but he betrayed them, and that's the worst possible thing you could do. And I'm probably going to mangle the line, but when Dutch says, you know, it's when William Holden is, he says, oh, you know, he's trying to give him a break and saying, you know what, Deke, you know, he gave his word. And Ernest Borgnine says, it doesn't matter that he gave his word. It matters who you gave your word to.
Right.
It's like that in and of itself is this call for decency from this indecent person.
Yeah.
And it just adds to that whole complexity of everything that's just rolled up.
But the, but again, it's also like you see there isn't like there nobody is right or wrong in that situation. He's trying to uphold his friend Deke, who frankly he feels guilty for abandoning Deke. And I think that's part of it. But like there is no loyalty to him. It's like he's keeping his promise, and Borgnine's like, you can't keep your promise to the wrong person. And it's like, yeah, nobody's right here. This is a circular argument where no one is going to win. Everyone is kind of their loyalties are all over the place. It's who's going to pay? Who do you happen to be around at the time? And you see it. And it's funny that I don't think Deke and Dutch, other than that flashback, they never really interact face to face again, do they? Like they kind of there are moments where they acknowledge each other, but right. they never have like an actual dialogue scene together. But their relationship is so key to the thematic elements of the film and the storyline. That again, the idea of them having that loyalty to each other, and Deke is feeling estranged. He's working for the good guys, quote unquote. But they are just looking for a paycheck, and he doesn't feel any sense of heart or meaning from what he's doing. He feels like they don't have a soul because they don't trust each other. You know what I mean? It's funny that the bad guys end up being, well, at least they're loyal to each other, but then you have these kinds of compromises where nobody is really loyal to anybody.
But you also look at the gang that is there with Deke, and they are... their behavior is abhorrent to them, to him. And so by transference, get the sense that, yeah, the Wild Bunch does terrible stuff, but they try to avoid the big shootout. They'll do it if they have to, but they try to avoid that stuff. They
True.
Don't.
Yeah.
So you get this overlay of Deke walking around horrified at the way, you know, you're behaving less than a human. He refers to them as gutter trash in front of them.
He's not a fan.
Right. And so there's this sense that there's even worse. And it's that code that the Wild Bunch lived by that Deke wishes. And the beautiful symbolism of the fact that there's always distance between Pike and Deke through the whole film. Like you said, they acknowledge each other, but it's not like they have a big sit down in the diner, like in Heat or something like that. There is that gulf that they can't cross, but you can sit there and say, Deke, what are you worried about? You could just run off with them and they'd never catch you.
Mm.
What is keeping you with these guys? You know, what is different? And is it just that Deke has, in a sense, ascended beyond either group?
Mm-hmm.
And so he's with a lesser group, a worse group, but the Wild Bunch is still not a good group. And like he acknowledges that much. Like
right.
he can't go back to either one. And in a sense, it's killing him inside because he wants to be free. He wants to be out and good and doing the right thing. And he can't. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really... Again, I keep using the word complex, but everything is so complex in this film.
He is the like the manifestation of the idea that this is an era that has long since passed, and he can no longer go back to what he used to be, and he can't really go forward. So he's kind of lost, and he has no place. And I have to kind of myself. Because truthfully, you know, I say nobody has loyalty to anybody, but the theme of the movie also seems to be that if you don't have loyalty, you have nothing. Because at the end of the day, what brings about the Wild Bunch's ultimate demise is their loyalty to one of their companions. They abandon him to save their own skin. They don't feel good about it, and they go back to save him, knowing that they're probably going to die in the process. But to them, that companionship, that bond is so important that even somebody like Angel, who's kind of screwed up and done stupid things and gotten them in trouble, they're still like, no, he's one of us, we're gonna go get him back. And that ends up being what kills them. It's very interesting. I also, speaking of Angel, early on when they early in the film when they first find out they got the washers instead of the silver, and he goes cheap, cheap, cheap. I was like, Tommy Wiseau totally stole that.
Yes,
from this movie.
Oh my gosh.
I could sit down with Mr. Wiseau, that's the only question I would ask him. I was like, did you steal the cheap, cheap, cheap from the Wild Bunch? Because I think you did.
And he would say, I don't know. What do you think? It's okay.
He'd go, ha ha, yeah. What a story, Sean. But it's also, you know, it's funny because I talked about Red Dead Redemption, the first video game, being kind of the door that opened the floodgates for my love of this genre. I'm playing Red Dead Redemption 2 now and found, I haven't beaten it yet, but there are a lot of themes that it focuses on. Similar ideas of it, we're moving into a new era, the industrialization and factories moving in, and the old West is kind of dying out, and the old, like the outlaw ways, are no longer the norm. And it's about like a group, a gang, trying to find their way and make their way through this world that's long since passed them by. But I thought that was really interesting that I was playing Red Dead Redemption, talked about that in the first episode, and see a lot of similar themes in Red Dead 2 to the Wild Bunch.
Oh,
but
cool.
There's lots of great stuff in this movie, too. It sounds like it's a downer. If you have seen it, you know that's not the case. And if you haven't seen it, it's not a depressing film. It's definitely, it will leave you feeling somber and kind of sad. It's definitely not on an up note, but there are moments of levity, and there are great, great performances here. Holden in particular, I think, is fantastic. Borgnine is great. But I love the other guys, too. I don't remember who's who, but there's Freddie Sykes. He's the old man who's kind of like, great, great performance. And it's Angel, Lyle, and then Tector, is that it?
Tector. Yes.
Yeah, so there's they in between these moments of like kind of like somberness, they'll go to like these camps and just like hook up with actual prostitutes. Apparently they hired prostitutes for those scenes. Just so Peckinpah made a joke. He's like, I wanted to make sure that I could always tell the press that Warner Brothers hired prostitutes for the actors.
And, also don't forget that Strother Martin is in this. So anybody who's a fan of Cool Hand Luke,
right,
you get to see one of the great Strother Martin performances as well as Coffer.
Right. But the action in this movie is fantastic. And again, they undermine your expectations because you're constantly being shown the aftermath of the horrors of the shootouts. I remember, after Angel shoots his wife, a shocking moment. He shoots her in the Mapache's arms.
Yep.
And he kind of laughs it off. He's like, aha, I like this guy. But the next scene, they show her funeral. Mm-hmm. Like they bring the body through. Again, you're always seeing the consequences of the action. Whereas in other movies, it might be dismissed or like, oh, whatever. There's a lot of great action in this movie. But I started wondering, I'm like, was there no humane society on set to watch these poor horses? Because like knock them down hills, they bury them in sand, they blow them up on a bridge. Sarah, my wife, happened to walk in and she was not happy at all about that moment.
I always find it funny how harm to animals seems to elicit a bigger reaction than harm to humans in films. It's, it's why we always have to save the dog now,
right?
unless it's
John Wick.
Yes. Well, I mean, that serves a story purpose. So,
right.
But no, I'm talking like, Independence Day. I'll never forget the theater breaking out into laughter as like the tunnels exploding and
are you talking about one of the single greatest moments in cinema? Boomer the dog running to safety.
I'm talking about a moment in cinema history. but I don't know. I guess I didn't look at the credits, but I don't think that they had the Humane Society
on set back in those days. There's a scene in the movie where it's a fantastic scene. I mean, the movie is full of incredible action. It's funny because it's a commentary on violence and it is not in favor of violence at all, but at the same time, the action sequences are really well shot and put together, and you have to admire them. But there's a great scene where their opponents are on the bridge. Deke and his ragtag group are on the bridge, and the Wild Bunch blows the bridge up. And in slow motion, you very clearly see these are real horses and real people plummeting into the river. And all I'm thinking is, like, my God, a horse had to have died on set. Like, this is insane.
I don't know if a horse did or not, but a quick head count of looking at the horses swimming downriver seemed to confirm they made it through.
They
okay.
made it okay.
And right. that's just what I'm very glad they have the shot of the horses swimming afterward, because that gives me at least the mental out to be like, okay, everybody made it through all right. And the thing is, if anybody was going to die in that sequence, the horses were actually less likely than the guys who were potentially getting trapped under them.
Right.
And so that had to be, I mean, it would have been great to interview the stuntmen who worked on that film, because there were a lot of things that were, you know, very, very tricky, undoubtedly to pull off.
Yes. So I am really, in all of this movie, kind of amazed that it got so beat up when it was released. It's amazing what time will do when you can look back on a movie and kind of look at it outside. I think people were so taken aback by the fact that there was so much violence and blood and the gunshots, the squibs had blood and the blah, blah, blah. But you look at the film and it feels like a statement against violence and a condemnation of that. And like you said, Unforgiven kind of visits similar themes. But I don't know. I'm kind of with you. I think I might prefer The Wild Bunch as much as I do love Unforgiven. Is there anything about The Wild Bunch that doesn't hold up for you watching it again? Is there anything that stood out to you as a weakness of it?
No. I can. And the thing is, I know that this makes me sound like, you know, dyed-in-the-wool, fanboy, apologist sort of thing, but I can honestly say that I've had a relationship with this film for long enough, and I've revisited it at different points in my life, and I actually come to love it more and more as I get older, because there are certain things about it that ring really, really true about how coming to terms with your choices in life, coming to terms with not being able to go back, and themes of betrayal and friendships and the complexity of wanting to defend the person that's no longer part of, you know, like there are so many things that as you gain life experience are so much even more resonant as you go forward. I can't think of a moment in this film that I would change or take out. What about you?
You know, at times, and I was going to ask you if you knew specifically, sometimes the pacing felt a little off, and maybe that's because this is my first viewing. I'm trying to get on the movie's wavelength, and sometimes I'm not sure where it's going. I'd be interested in, when I watch it again, as I'm sure I will, seeing if those things are erased. But I was going to ask you, do you know what were the major differences between this cut and the director's cut? Or, I mean, the theatrical cut?
Well, it's been long enough that I think that one of the major differences is there's more flashback, establishing more of the past relationship between Pike and Deke, and I think that some of the things are just longer sequences, because I think that some of the stuff, you know, some of the violence that was more objectionable was cut down. Mm-hmm. I believe that the fight at the end is shorter. It's not like half as long or something, but it like just trimmed a little bit for the sake of it. And because, I mean, after all, the score of that magnificent ending is simply gunfire. So yes, it's probably a lot easier to trim something like that instead of having to try to rescore it or anything.
Right.
Like.
Well, that's the interesting. A lot of these action sequences are just the sound effects, which I thought was very effective. Like the train sequence, you almost expect like this blaring heroic music on the soundtrack, but they just use the sound effects of the train and the machinery and the gunshots. there's no dressing it up to make it more glamorous than what it right. really is, which was totally Peckinpah's intention.
And how crazily intense is that train heist sequence?
I loved it. I thought, I mean, this movie has one sequence after another of just this incredible, it's like, it's film school in a nutshell, how you build tension and how you edit an action sequence and how you put together. Yeah, it feels like a movie. I feel like this is hyperbole in a way, but it does feel like a movie you could watch and feel like it doesn't feel dated. Other than the obvious things, obviously there are things that, you know, the violence is not quite on par with what we expect from movie violence these days. It's not quite as shocking, but it feels so modern to me. The storytelling and the themes and the characters and the places they take the movie, it felt very modern. And so on the flip side of things you might not have liked about it, what works for you the most about this movie? What stands out to you?
Well, I just want to take it as an aside to say that to your point about it not feeling dated, about it feeling still relevant and all of that, this is like a Tarantino film before Tarantino existed.
Right.
It really is.
It does feel that way, yeah.
And I think that's the thing that I hope really helps us find a more modern audience, is the fact that this feels like a Tarantino movie. And I really think I'd love to see a double feature, although it would be the longest double feature in history, of like this and Hateful Eight,
right,
sort of thing. I mean, ooh, this is shorter than Hateful Eight, everybody. So just so you know,
it's also better, much better.
We'll debate Hateful Eight at some other time, but I can say that the things that really work best, that resonate most, and have just endeared it to me from the beginning, are the smaller dialogue moments. I love all of the action. I think the tension is great. I think the stunts are spectacular. I love everything that they do, but the smaller moments, the flashback of Pike getting shot, when he's with the woman who's married, mm-hmm. and Ernest Borgnine's speech, you know, it doesn't matter that he gave his word, it matters who you gave it to, and the less, you know, all of us dream of being a child again. Like, there are so many philosophical nuggets to really chew on throughout this entire film. I think it is unquestionably, there's just something so comforting about a film like this being so philosophically rich, mm-hmm. That's why those moments. And I can tell you also that Mapache's death is one of the most gratifying moments in cinema history, where you're like, good, I, you know, no matter how else this goes, I'm glad that SOB ate it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. It follows one of the big shock moments of the movie when he slits Angel's throat.
Oh, geez.
So you want it more than anything. You're like, oh, thank you, finally.
Right. Yes.
But I'm with you. I was very pleasantly surprised by the contemplative nature of the film, and the quiet moments, and the scene of them leaving the village, that goes on so long, but it feels so necessary. I love the relationships and the commentary the relationships have on just the time period and what's happening, and this, just the general sadness that kind of imbues every frame of this film. It is, I still just can't get over how ignorant people of the time were. To me, there was never... Again, I have to remember my sensibilities are different. I grew up in a different era, but to me, there's never a point in the film where it feels like the violence is glorified or celebrated in any way. It feels disturbing. It feels upsetting, and that stood out to me a lot, and I was very impressed by that.
Take solace in the fact that even Citizen Kane took 20 years to find love, right? How many?
Yeah, it's true.
How many films go underappreciated? Even Heat did. And then you find out what an incredible influence it was on somebody like Christopher Nolan. And so in a sense, these things do live on, because they got to somebody and they were able to carry that spark forward. So now that it's streaming on Netflix, I can only hope that more people discover it. Because yeah. I really, really think the more people get their eyes on this, the more people will say, oh, wow, this is pretty great. So,
yeah. I agree. Well, I think final ratings, let's say on a rating scale of cheap, cheap, cheaps, how many, one being the lowest and five being the highest, would you give The Wild Bunch?
I give it five cheap, 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 Sean.
There you go. I'm going to give it four just because this is my first viewing and it's a lot to take in. But if I'm looking at it from a film perspective, from an analytical perspective, technique and just everything it's trying to do, I feel like this is a five cheap, cheap, cheap movie. It is undoubtedly, even as I give it a 4-star rating, I know it's a masterpiece. And I feel like it's just... I need to digest it and I need to watch it again and really
totally fair.
Having kind of looked at it, giving it another chance now that I am understanding and kind of talking through a few of these things with you. But it feels like a classic. It absolutely is. And it feels like an integral film that I hope people notice more, like you're saying. And I'm thrilled I had the opportunity. Thank you for showing it to me.
Hey, anything I could do. I'm just glad Netflix was reading my brainwaves this time.
So. Aren't we all? And if you'd like your brainwaves being read, check out thenerdparty.com where we are always in tune with what you want. And you can't explain it, but you can check out the great podcast. John, you have some great podcasts. Tell the people at home about it.
Oh, sure. You can find me here on the network. I'm on Aggressive Negotiations, which is a Star Wars podcast, which we do deep dive stuff. You know, it's not like breaking news or anything like that. We're doing philosophical stuff. Our most recent one as of this recording was dissecting whether people are making too much of Obi-Wan's lines about truths and points of view. So that was a fun philosophical one. And I'm also on Retro Perspective with Mike Schindler, where we are looking back at the year 1994 and celebrating 25 years of its influence on cinema. And
that was a great year. If only because Dumb and Dumber was released that year.
It's a very interesting year. We're very early on in the year, but we have coined the term the Esther House effect. So
explain.
Oh, Joe Esther House. You know, famed screenwriter who gave us Basic Instinct.
Oh, okay.
we watched a film called Blank starring Madeline Stowe, which is like a crime thriller with a cop love interest thing going on, and a totally grafted on gratuitous pair of sex scenes.
Oh, perfect.
Where we were basically, oh, it's the Esther House effect.
90s. Like this is the 90s we're all about.
Basic Instinct comes along. Everybody grafts this stuff right onto their movies. I'm so glad that era is over with. But yes, that's where you can find me on the network.
And you can follow the network at Join Nerd Party on Twitter. Also find us on Facebook, The Nerd Party. And I'm on Twitter at @YeSeanDorman if you want to check me out, as I'm sure you do. And John, where can people find you on Twitter?
Oh, I'm Kessel Junkie. I'm lurking around. You can find me there.
And if you like what you're hearing, feel free to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or wherever you might be listening. We thank you so much for doing so, and we bid you a fond farewell. Until next time.